Welcome back to Midpoint on WMNF, your mid-Florida, mid-week, mid-morning source for news and public affairs with a local perspective. I'm your host, Shelley Reback. The big news from last week is the ignominious departure from the field of battle of Ron DeSanctimonious, who finally gave up his predilection for private planes and his catastrophic campaign for president to return to Florida, where he can continue to be the vengeful and vindictive, bigoted, and bullying authoritarian he's been and will continue to be for his next 2 years as governor. As Peter Schorsch from Florida Politics said, Daddy's coming home drunk and he's going to kick the dog. Meanwhile, the Florida legislature is in session and the burning question is just how many Republican legislators will have miraculously recovered their spines and will turn away from the cynical DeSantis culture wars to do some actual governing, since their hopes of cabinet positions and ambassadorships have now disappeared. Will we see the same sycophantic and slavish obeisance to the whims of Herr DeSantis as we saw for the past two sessions? Or are we destined to continue to suffer under the DeSantis jackboot? Time will tell. I know one of the people most interested in the answer to that question is Democratic Minority House Leader and local legislative representative Fentress Driscoll, who will be joining us on Midpoint next week. So please stay tuned to hear from her on January 31st. Now moving on. Welcome back to Midpoint. Meanwhile, on January 27th, this Saturday, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. It is held on the date of the liberation of Auschwitz concentration camp by the Russians in 1945. And as we do every year, we acknowledge the occasion with a program focused on some aspect of the Holocaust. Today, my guest is Rachel Cerotti, a documentarian and photojournalist, an educator and memoirist, who spent more than a decade retracing and documenting the wartime history of her grandmother, Hanna Dubova, a stateless Czech refugee who fled Prague on a Kinder transport train to Denmark at age 14 and was the only member of her family to survive the Holocaust. Her grandmother's story is the framework for We Share the Same Sky, the retelling of family history becomes the history itself, which is an award-winning memoir, a podcast, a book, an educational program, and now an exhibit at the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg. We Share the Same Sky aims to encourage all of us to be curious about where and who we are and where we come from and why it matters. Rachel's grandmother, Hanna, asks what her story means to the next generation, and Rachel does her best to find out. At a time when the memory of the Holocaust is endangered, Rachel, through her grandmother, brings us a vivid memoir of displacement and loss. I want to welcome Rachel Cerotti to Midpoint today.
Hello. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me.
And I thank her for being with us. Rachel, you're with us, right?
Yes, I am. Hi. Thank you for having me today.
Great. Let's start with this. Why did you decide to spend a decade following and documenting your grandmother's journey as a refugee from Hitler? So which came first for you, the idea for the project or your personal journey to retrace her experience?
Well, I can say at the start that I didn't decide to spend a decade. The decade kind of just passed by, as years often do. I became interested in my grandmother's story when I was actually in college and for the first time in my life living nearby her. And I simply just started sitting with her and having these storytelling sessions, and we would hang out, and it was very casual with no big grand plan. But simultaneously, I was also beginning a career as a storyteller, as a photojournalist, as a documentarian, and the two things kind of went together. And she passed away about a year and a half after we started talking and left behind this incredible archive that was not a secret archive, but just her life as she left it behind. And it had all these beautiful photographs and diaries from back during the war and letters between her and her parents when she was escaped to Denmark and all this other incredible primary source material. And I got very lost in it in my early 20s and began to digitize everything. And that would eventually lead me into the next decade, which was all of my 20s and then even into my early 30s, following her story around the world and becoming deeply interested in how stories are passed from one generation to the next.
Now, that's one of the things that's kind of unique about your ability to document your grandmother's story. I believe she kept a journal of her experiences, didn't she? And she was also interviewed for the Shoah Project, which is the archive of survivor stories told in their own words that was begun, I think, by Steven Spielberg after Schindler's List, and it's now based at the University of Southern California. And more than 3,000 of these audio and visual testimonies from Holocaust survivors are now available for viewing or listening online. So your grandmother really gifted you a lot of material, didn't she?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in her own personal life, she was somebody who journaled and somebody who captioned her photographs. And, you know, even in her diaries, the way she would write to herself was like there was a lot of engagement of the characters in terms of like as a storyteller. You know, some people write and they're like explaining to themselves who this person was, which is really feels like writing for an audience, even if she was her own audience. And then, yeah, as she got older later on, you know, many years after the war, she was very generous in telling her story. She was a very vocal survivor. She would speak in classrooms. And yes, in 1998, She recorded her testimony with Shoah Foundation, which now has an archive of more than 55,000 Holocaust survivor testimonies, plus testimonies from people from other survivors and witnesses and liberators of other genocides. So there's Rwandans and Cambodians and all types of other people in there with incredible life stories. And so they played a big role in this story also being developed into many of the educational materials that now come along with my grandmother's history.
Wow. Well, let me invite our listeners, too. If you have your own personal family histories, particularly about the Holocaust, I invite you to call in and share that with us. Give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. But feel free to give us a call and give us a brief history of your own family's experiences in the Holocaust. I know that there are a number of people locally who have that experience. I'd like to hear a little bit from your grandmother in her own words now, Rachel. So, Jessica, would you play clip number one, please?
Today's date is March 25th, 1998. We are in Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania, in the United States, and the language of the interview is English. Please tell us your name, your date of birth, and your place of birth.
My name is Hannah Sekel Drucker. My maiden name was Dubova. The male get Dub, the female get Ova at the end. I was born July 2nd, 1925 in Kolín, at that time Czechoslovakia.
Can you spell the name of the town that you were born?
K-O-L-I-N.
And where is this located?
It's like 50 kilometers east of Prague. It takes like 1 hour by train.
My grandmother sat down to tape this video when she was 73 years old, more than 20 years ago. She's sitting in front of the camera. It zoomed in on her, like a headshot. Her bookshelf is in the background. The interviewer is off screen. The video is a recorded testimony, and it sits in an archive of thousands upon thousands of testimonies of Holocaust survivors. It's 4 hours long. I knew a version of her story as a kid. I knew she survived the Holocaust, that she was the only one in her family alive at the end of the war, that she escaped over and over again, I knew her home was covered in paintings and photographs of Prague. Masks and paperweights and postcards from different places. Pictures of family she lost and those who came after. Every piece of art in her house had a story. Sometimes we would break her stories. Sometimes, at holiday meals, we knock over the precious stemware. The sharp edges of the thick red glass would cover the floor. The disposable pieces of her childhood memories laid out in front of her descendants. I took her stories for granted at the time, but that's the role of the grandchild, to accept what came before as normal. My grandmother was stateless for 17 years, and the last time she saw her family was when she was 14. I was 21 when she died, but in a way, I've spent more time with her after her death than I did when she was alive. Her history has become a delicate spider web, woven together by the thin threads of family stories passed from one generation to the next. In these stories, time isn't chronological. The retelling of family memories has become the history itself. And I want to invite you to come with me into the homes of strangers, to the places where people saved her life, where a story of war is experienced by the next generation. But first, I want to introduce you to my grandmother, Hanna Dubova. Dubova means oak tree in Czech. My grandmother was strong like an oak tree. She knew that too.
I am extremely independent. I make my own decisions. I take my own consequences. When my grandchildren says, you know, this isn't fair, life isn't fair, I says, nobody told you life is fair. Life is not fair, but you have to deal with it.
All right, thanks for sending us that clip, Rachel. I think it's important for setting the stage to understand and hear from your grandmother in her own voice, and also to hear from you about how you felt as you listened to your grandmother's stories. And I wonder, how did the deep dive into her personal history affect your understanding of the Holocaust? Did you have education about it in school, or you know, what did you know coming into it?
Sure. So just for the audience to know, what you heard from me speaking there is the first episode of the We Share the Same Sky podcast. And so just to give some context for that. And, you know, growing up, I always had heard my grandmother's story, as I've said, for a lot of, not for all, but for many grandchildren who grow up, you know, as a descendant of someone who survived a war or a genocide, it's very often, you know, it's in a way it feels normal because that's all you know. And so for us, you know, we knew that my grandmother was the only survivor in her family. We knew that she survived because of the kindness of strangers. Like, her story is one, as she would call it, an uplifting story. And I always say that, you know, in no world should someone who has to leave home at 14 and be on their own for the rest of their life, in no world is that an uplifting story. But certainly in the landscape of the other stories that come out of war and genocide, it really is, because she was so focused on the people who helped her along the way. And so even when she retold her story, it was very important for her. Like, she didn't linger much on all the bad that happened and the fact that her family was murdered in extermination camps. And she really, really emphasized that because of people she didn't know, her life was saved. And in many ways, not only does that teach a lesson about that period in history, but it also really teaches a lesson about how much power we have in our own narratives in terms of what we want to leave to our next generation.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, you could dwell on the bad parts, or you could emphasize the good parts. And one of the things I got from your podcast and listening to your grandmother, and also from the gentleman, the Danish gentleman named Bent, who was her fellow refugee, was that the Holocaust trauma is not limited to the experiences of those who survived concentration camps or slave labor camps, although those experiences should not be discounted or diminished at all. But refugees who fled the war are also traumatized by their experiences, and many experience some survivor guilt when they lose their families, but they themselves are spared. And even the decision to leave and the pressure that it puts on the families who remain behind is really fraught. So I'd like to play another clip from your podcast, We Share the Same Sky. And this clip includes the voice of your grandmother and some radio newsreel audio about the appeasement of Hitler by Great Britain's then Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain in an attempt to avoid a war in Europe in 1938. Hitler demanded more European territory to expand Germany. And so in the hopes of avoiding another war in Europe, he was basically gifted the country of Czechoslovakia, and the Czechs had no say in that. This is the event that prompted your family's efforts to leave Czechoslovakia and that ultimately resulted in the beginning of your grandmother's journey as a stateless refugee when she was 14 and was sent on a train to Denmark and became her family's only survivor of the Holocaust. So let's play that clip, Jess, number two.
September 29th, 1938. It's a Thursday, and it's raining in Prague. Hannah's 13 years old. Her brother's 9. His name is Peter. They live with their parents in a modest second-floor apartment. It has a wraparound balcony that connects them to their neighbors and the communal toilet. It's a school day. Her father sits at the breakfast table and reads his favorite newspaper. It's written in German, the most influential liberal democratic newspaper in Czechoslovakia. The paper hides his face even as the corners fold over. Hannah reads the headlines on the other side. It says something about Hitler wanting a part of Czechoslovakia, but she's distracted by her own thoughts. She can't stop thinking about a boy named Dasha.
We were waiting all very happily just now, about 20 minutes ago, at a rather threatening sky, but not a particularly bad one. Suddenly, rain began to fall, and it got harder and harder until the tarmac of the airport is skiddy and flooded, and everybody's looking very wet.
When it's time, Hannah gathers her bag and takes the streetcar to school. She and her classmates bow to the teacher as they enter the classroom. Then they take their seats and sit straight with their hands behind their back. It's the mandatory posture. In history class, she learns about the Great World War, which feels ancient. She's taught that Czechoslovakia was created in 1918 at the end of that war. She understands that before her country gained independence, that it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And she knows that her father fought in this war, but it all feels irrelevant. It happened before she was born. Hannah goes directly home after school. She has to finish her homework before she can meet her friends at the gymnasium. And maybe, at the gymnasium, she'll see Dasha. She likes him so much. At the end of that normal Thursday, on September 29th, 1938, Hannah lies in bed. It's become common to fall asleep to the sounds of her mother shushing her father as they listen to the radio. They're listening to a news report. She hears the radio static, but can't make out the words. She closes her eyes. She tells herself stories built from today's memories. She narrates the stories with the words she keeps hearing from her parents and grandparents. It can never happen here.
And now they bring her up. The police are coming forward. And the Lord Chamberlain is to be seen down there waiting to greet Mr. Chamberlain. I believe he'll be the first person to meet him as he steps out of the machine.
I want to thank the British people for what they have done. Next, I want to say that the settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace.
Hannah didn't know it yet, but this is what happened on that September 29th, the Thursday in 1938. There was a conference held in Munich, Germany. Hitler had now been in power for 5 years. It had only taken him the first 6 months to consolidate power. He turned a democracy into a one-party dictatorship. He drafted emergency legislation that suspended civil liberties. He got rid of habeas corpus. He deputized the stormtroopers. He targeted communists, socialists, state delegates, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witness, the mentally disabled, Germans of African descent, and Jews. He overfilled the jails, and then used schools and gymnasiums for his prisoners. And then, when those were over capacity, he built concentration camps. He murdered his opponents. He burned their books. And he amended the German Constitution and gave himself emergency powers. All in 6 months.
We were always taught not to make waves. We were taught blend into the woodwork. If somebody calls you some kind of a name, you know, dirty Jew or something, that was about the worst. We never were physically beaten up. We were taught, let it pass, let it go. I think the parents went through it, the grandparents went through it. They survived, so they felt, you know, don't answer, don't go back, don't fight for yourself. Don't fight for yourself.
So, Rachel, you know, when I first heard this podcast and I heard this particular section of it, the words that you used to describe what your grandmother was hearing from her parents, it can't ever happen here. It can never happen here. It really haunted me, particularly given where we are today, where President Biden is making a hallmark of his reelection campaign, the threats to democracy by the Republicans. And it was so interesting to me to hear that the echoes of that in what your grandmother was experiencing before the start of her refugee journey. And I wonder if you think that or how you think the stories of people who went through those experiences, like your grandmother, then are useful to us today in terms of looking at what is happening around us in our own history, our daily lives. I just wonder if you see the parallels and you hear the echoes of that today.
Well, I'll answer that in two parts. First, you know, my grandmother, this tape that you're hearing from her was recorded in 1998 with USC Schiller Foundation. And so I was able to pull this from a 4.5-hour audiovisual testimony that was, you know, left behind. And at the very early first clip you shared, you would hear the interviewer interviewing her. Mm-hmm. So this is not for my conversation with her, the audio. And, you know, of that 4.5 hours, when I was making this show, I pulled out what felt relevant to me, because I think that for anybody who's a student of history, whether you're studying that academically or you're just somebody who reads books or likes having conversations, we gravitate towards ideas and stories that feel like they have some relevance. So I'm a very big proponent of making connections to the past, not comparisons. And when it comes to studying these types of oral histories or personal narratives, particularly from a couple generations ago, we have this really deeply profound experience in being able to see life before, during, and after a war. So when we look at current events happening now, it's impossible to understand what's really happening. But when we study a war, we can say, okay, you know, from 1933 to 1939, we know what Europe looked like as the rise of Nazism happened. And then from 1939 to 45, we can look at what happened during the war and how things progressed and how things got progressively more violent and then, you know, turned towards peace. And then from 45 on, we have, you know, these many, many decades to look at what it means to reconcile with history and what it means to thrive after trauma. And so for me, the Holocaust survivor testimony and particularly that generation who really gave a gift to us next generations by leaving their stories behind, we get to see this long arc of history and watch what it looks like to say those words, it can never happen here, to enduring it happening there, to getting to the recovery process. And so that's where I think that really some profound wisdom lies in what these people left behind, is that we get to see what it means to be wrong, to experience that, and then to recover from it.
I see. Well, you know, I have a text message here that's come in from 2578, a number ending in 2578, who says, my mother and her family were taken by the Russians in the winter of 1943 from their home in Poland to Siberia. En route, her father, her two brothers, and her sister all died of starvation. They were eventually released and traveled by train to India and eventually Iran and on to Africa, where they lived in displaced camps run by missionaries before being sponsored by an uncle in Chicago to come to the United States. She told us her stories about her experiences. Wow, what would you advise that person who heard those stories about her from her mother about, I mean, that's an extraordinary journey that she just related right there. How would you advise that person to preserve that for future generations and or to make it known maybe, you know, in some way by educating kids in school or giving her testimony to the Holocaust Museum or in some ways just saving what an extraordinary journey her mother took from Poland to Russia to India to Iran to Africa. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, I would say, first of all, what's particularly incredible is that it really breaks the stereotype that, like, war happens in a certain region. And I'm particularly fond of the stories that connects us, right? And so when we see the migration pattern of people who are escaping war and realizing that, you know, I kind of see the world as a little bit of a spider web. You pull a little bit of a thread in one place and something on the other side of the web moves. And so a story like that really gives a really beautiful example of how we are all connected and how we all can suffer together and heal together. So I think that in itself is so important for that specific story. And then in terms of preserving it, listen, I'm a big fan of the memoir genre because I think stories told in first person are the most they're the best to relate to and really the most honest because it's our interpretation and our experience with the story. So for this person whose mother went through that, being able to just sit and write stream of consciousness, don't worry about your audience, do it in bullet points, do it in whatever creative approach you want, but really writing about what that story means to them, recalling as many sensory and historical details as they can, as they were told it, and then allowing their own reflections on it to enter the narrative. Because, you know, as the next generation, this is our story also. So we have to contribute what we feel and what we see as the important points as well.
Yeah, I think that would be so valuable, if only to the rest of her family, her future generations of her family. But I also hear echoes in that story of the point you made earlier about all the people along the way that the refugees encountered who assisted them or supported them or helped them, you know, get to the next phase of their journey, the next point in their life. Think about all the different people from different parts of the world in that particular story who were somehow involved in her mother's journey. I think that is also interesting, and I think it sort of relates to what you were saying earlier about how important the stories of the witnesses are, the people who encountered the refugees along the way.
Absolutely.
So the other thing I wanted to mention is, in hearing the parts about your grandmother's story the early parts of her story. You know, she's only 14 when she gets on this Kinder transport train, and she goes with a boy, her teenage boyfriend, Dasha. You know, it just, there were so many echoes to me in this part of her story that seemed to sort of remind me of Anne Frank's diary. This business of, you know, here she is, she's leaving on this journey where she's going into the unknown. She's only 14 years old. She's leaving her family and her city and her place in the world behind. But she thought it was kind of a great adventure, and she was very focused on the attentions of her boyfriend. And it just felt to me in some ways like those portions of Anne Frank's diary where she becomes enamored of Peter, and basically the sense that life goes on even during these traumatic events. What are your thoughts about that?
Sure. Well, I'm just going to make one small correction, which is that she wasn't actually on a Kinder transport. So
okay.
It's something very similar to that, but she was able to get out of Czechoslovakia because of her involvement with the Zionist youth movement. And so she, this whole group of kids that she left with were all between the ages of 14 and 16, and they were all members of this youth group. It wasn't political, it wasn't religious, but, you know, it was like a summer camp program, basically. And they were able to get out because the Zionist youth movement, along with the Danish government and a group called the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, had actually created this rescue mission and were able to take these kids out of Czechoslovakia and put them onto farms in rural Denmark. So she left with this boy, Dasha, and my family is still friends with his family, you know, four generations later, which is a wonderful story in itself. And they were able to go. And as you mentioned, she was like quite enamored. I mean, she was excited, but in her retellings, you know, she has stories where her emotions are, you know, excited, and there's some romance in it all, and not just romance, the boy, a romance with travel. She hadn't left the country before. You know, and as she said in her testimony once, you know, it was like there was energy in the air, like it was exciting but scary. You know, but we have, when we tell stories of history, we really have to remember that the people going through it don't know what happens next.
Yeah, good point. Know. That's a very good point.
Right?
The people going through it, and when they're in the midst of it, they don't know what will happen next. We only know that to some extent from looking back.
Exactly. So she was a really good storyteller. I always think that if my grandmother grew up in a different time and place, we would have had the same career. Like, she was a really good storyteller in the sense that when she was telling me her story, she told it from that perspective, right? She would go back and forth between the recognition that she would never see her parents again, that, you know, 6 million were murdered, plus many million more who are not Jewish. And she would, but she would really take you to the emotion of that moment. And so she wasn't just with this boy, Sasha. She was with all these other friends. And, you know, when you're a teenager, I mean, all of us, my guess is most people listening have been a teenager before, or they are a teenager now. Like, we get involved in these, like, youth activities that really feel like these friends become like family, and it becomes very exciting. And it's this time in your life where you're sort of identifying yourself as your own individual and your own person. And she was very much in that process. And my grandmother from the very beginning had a very like spirited personality. She was deeply independent. She always had kind of been that way. And so like my mom and I will talk about it, like was her ability to survive a function of, you know, what she had to like learn how to be during the war, or was it kind of her foundational personality as well? And we think it's a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
But so when they get to Denmark, they all get put on different farms, but they do, this group of kids gets to meet, you know, every week or every couple weeks and gossip in their native language and talk about learning Danish and learn some Hebrew and practice some Jewish culture together. And so she really kind of had a family in this group of young refugees in Denmark for at least the early part of the war. And that would change as the war went on and things, you know, were always constantly changing. But she kind of had this group of friends, and for the majority of them, they would all become the only survivors in their family, and they would all survive themselves because of the Danes willing to take them in, and then when Sweden took them in a couple years later after that.
Yeah. All right. Well, listeners, if you have a personal family history that you'd like to share with us about the Holocaust or about a refugee experience, give us a call at 813-239-9663, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text 813-433-0885 if you have a family history story about the Holocaust or a refugee experience that you'd like to share with us, or questions for Rachel Cerati, who is the memoirist and storyteller and podcaster, who has given us her her story in We Share the Same Sky, The Retelling of Family History Becomes the History Itself. It's the story of her grandmother's refugee journey as a stateless person from Czechoslovakia and the only survivor of her family during World War II and during the Holocaust. All right, maybe let's play another clip that you've given us from the podcast and hear a little bit more, and then I'll have some questions for you, Rachel.
It was obvious now. Neither Hannah's family nor Dasha's family would be able to get out. But there were some options for the children. Rescue missions were set in motion. The Kinder Transport is probably the best known. That was organized by the British and saved about 10,000 Jewish children by bringing them to England. In America, a senator from my home state in Massachusetts proposed to build a Congress for a similar plan in the United States, but public opinion said no. The wife of the U.S. Commissioner of Immigration, who happened to also be the cousin of President Roosevelt, publicly stated about the Jewish kids, quote, 20,000 charming children would all too soon grow into 20,000 ugly adults. Such racism didn't feel unique at this time. Walls were being built around borders. In the cases of some countries, like Czechoslovakia, the walls kept people in. And in other places, like America, the walls were built to keep people out. But Hannah was lucky, and so was Dasha. They were members of the Zionist youth movement, and that gave them an option to leave.
Let's go to Hakshara. Hakshara means preparation to toil the land in Palestine, if the British would allow that.
Zionism was a movement by the Jewish people to find a homeland. During the years of Hitler's rule, it became an increasingly popular movement, even for the most assimilated Jews. Hannah and Dasha were both members of their chapter of the youth movement, and it is because of this involvement that they were able to flee Czechoslovakia. The Zionist movement applied to an organization called the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And it was because of them that my grandmother's group of friends was saved.
I need to know the backstory of this. I found, did you know the story behind all this?
I don't know. Either way, it might be a different story.
So okay. It was so amazing. One time
That's Ava Bergman, Dasha's daughter. Dasha, Hannah's first love. Our families have been friends for four generations. But I only got close with them when I started researching my grandmother's life. On this day, we are sitting with her brother Michael and his son. We're at Michael's home in Copenhagen, eating cake and drinking tea, while reading the letters and memoirs written by Hannah and Dasha. So here's the story.
I have lived a lot abroad. And one time, there was a little private library in the place where I was. It was a big place with a lot of people. And I think someone put it by my door, female saints, East and West. And then it spoke about all these women who were really amazing women in Christianity and Hinduism and all this different. And then there was one little chapter about Judaism, and said in Judaism there are no saints. It doesn't exist. But there's one woman, if there should be, who should, and she went with her dad to Palestine, like maybe 100 years ago, a little bit earlier than that. And there was no infrastructure. There was a lot of malaria, and it was really, really poor. And so she took it upon herself to help people. And so what she did, she went back to the U.S. and raised money to educate some nurses.
This woman, Henrietta Zold, was born in Baltimore in 1860. At the age of 49, she began campaigning to establish health and social welfare services for the Arabs and the Jews of Palestine. This was her life's work, and it extended to protecting the persecuted children in Europe during World War II. As Ava continues the story, you can hear her brother Michael murmuring responses in the background.
And what happened was, when Hitler took over, she realized that she couldn't save everyone, but she could try to save the children. And at that time, the British had a deal with the Ottoman Empire that there could only be this many Jews coming to Palestine a year. Yeah. And so she made a deal that a part of this would be children. So they went to Denmark, and from there they would then go to Palestine.
I was one of the chosen ones. I learned later that you were not just picked to go. The parents paid quite a large sum of money to get their children out. My brother couldn't go because he was young, too young.
My grandmother said it was like receiving a lottery ticket to be allowed to leave.
We stood in front of the Gestapo for night and days to get exit permits to leave. The war already was declared. But we did leave. We did go by train through Berlin to Denmark.
Hannah had no idea that this would be the beginning of nearly two decades as a stateless person. It was just the first stop in her refugee story.
The first step in her refugee story. You know, it's just so important that you... explained and throughout the podcast, gave such attention to the influence of others on your grandmother's journey, Rachel. I think that, it's kind of like a pinball game for these refugees. You know, so much depends on the help that they get from individuals, from people, from organizations, as to how their journey goes, as to how their story goes. And that was one of the things that I noticed and felt in listening to your podcast.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, I think it's of the utmost importance because, you know, all of us as individuals, like we can't change global politics individually.
Right.
It's too much of an effort. However, you know, while we might not be able to change someone's status as a refugee or whether or not they have permission to go to one country or whether their family gets saved or whether their belongings come with them, we can treat them as human beings along the way. And my grandmother's experience and the way she chose to tell her story really highlighted that, because the people who treated her, you know, she'd be in all these different foster families in Denmark, moving from home to home to home, and then in Sweden again, moving from place to here and there. And when individuals treated her like she was a human being, like she belonged, like she was part of the family, and invited her to the family meals and really welcomed her to come to Christmas and sit at the table with them and give her a warm bed, like her experience changed very, very drastically without any of the, like, details of, you know, her actual refugee experience changed, her actual emotional experience did.
Right.
And that's what we as individuals can do for one another. Like, we can really have great and immediate impact on each other's emotional experiences as we move through any type of life experience.
All right. Well, I've got a call here from Tim and Brandon, who's been holding a while. Let me bring him on the air and see what he has to say. Tim, you're on the air.
Hello.
Are you with us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got a friend, a longtime friend. His mom's 90-something. She has dementia. But she fled. She wasn't in Germany. She fled one of the surrounding occupied countries. They were fleeing from the Russians. They didn't want to get caught up with the Russians. So the Americans saved them. And they, before they came to America, they were still over there. And like I said, she has dementia now, and she keeps relating the story that she was in a field and playing with a kid, and the kid picked up a grenade and blew up.
Oh, that's terrible. That's tragic. Yeah. You know, that's the experience of a lot of people in wartime in countries that are currently enmeshed in war. So, yeah, that's not an unusual experience. But thanks for calling in and sharing it with us, Tim. Appreciate your call.
Yeah. And one other thing, we are Jehovah's Witnesses, and Hitler called us Bible Forcers, and we're a people that stood up to Hitler, and many of my brothers and sisters lost their lives. But I just wanted to relate that story.
Yeah, thank you for your call, and thanks for bringing that up, too. It's important that everyone remember that, you know, Hitler's attacks during the Holocaust and were not limited just to the Jewish people, of course. That was the largest group that was affected by his bigotry. But Jehovah's Witnesses and the Roma and the Sinti people and political dissidents, all of those people were treated the same. So thank you for calling in, Tim. We appreciate it. All right. Did you find any significant differences or similarities, Rachel, in how the refugee experience was recalled or assimilated between your grandmother's memories and those of her contemporaries, like her friend Dasha, from what you heard from his family, or Bent from Denmark? Did they see it the same way or differently? I mean, my best friends... parents are Holocaust survivors. And, you know, what I noticed between them and many of their Holocaust survivor friends was, you know, people integrate these experiences very differently. Some people shut them out completely. Other people can't stop talking about them. You know, and I just wonder, you know, what you found in talking to so many people about their refugee experiences.
Sure, and I'm gonna relate this with the caller who thank you for that story. One of my favorite people I've ever met was a woman in Boston, which is where I grew up, who was a survivor who was also Jehovah's Witness, and she would often tell a story to our students about her father was killed because he refused to sign the Nazi oath. And I just think she was so incredible with sharing her story, and so I thank the caller for bringing that up. I've had, you know, one of the things that my grandmother's story has led me to is the profoundly powerful experience of working with survivors, you know, who've had many, many different experiences and their descendants. And you will find that across the board, nobody deals with their trauma the same way, and everyone recovers differently. And in different grieving communities, you will find that as well. So, you know, friends of mine who have grandparents who survived Auschwitz or another concentration camp are going to have a very different time processing that than my grandmother, who was not in a camp, did not witness death herself, even though she experienced the death of her family. And for, you know, the family members of the people that are directly linked to her story, as you would meet them in the podcast or the book or the exhibition, they're going to all have very different experiences depending what country they ended up in. So my grandmother ended up coming to America in 1950. Dasha's family stayed in Denmark. Other of her contemporaries would go on to Israel.
Rachel, I apologize, but I'm going to cut you off here because we're coming to the end of the show, and I want to play that one last clip from your podcast, We Share the Same Sky, because it relates to what you're saying now about the experiences of different refugees coming from different places and going to different places. So toward the end of your podcast, We Share the Same Sky, you begin to meet and work with Syrian, Afghani, and Somalian refugees, and you include the story of one named Moody, who was a semi-professional Syrian basketball player who flees the civil war in Damascus in 2012 and crosses the Mediterranean to eventually settle in Denmark himself. And in this clip, we hear the voice of Bent, who is an elderly rabbi in Denmark, who was one of the people who fled Denmark to Sweden with your grandmother when the Germans invaded Denmark and your grandmother had to flee again. And we hear a bit from Moody, the Syrian refugee. And for people who don't know this, the Danish Jews were rescued by the people of Denmark, by the citizens and the resistance movement there when Denmark was invaded by the Germans. They were picked up and sent to neutral Sweden in 1943 in fishing boats. Something like 95% of the Jews living in Denmark were saved by the people of Denmark. And there is an ongoing example exhibit at the Florida Holocaust Museum about that, along with an exhibit of Rachel's work from her her project, We Share the Same Sky. So let's play that last clip, Jess.
When the Second World War ended, I mean, we were extremely optimistic. That was still even before we heard terrible things that happened in the camps. But we thought that mankind had suffered so much that they would understand that war was not the answer. We had lived to see miracles happen on the sea. And you know, you were with me. When I'm standing there at the beach looking at that water, I see myself on the bottom of that sea. And I think of these thousands of people who try to come over the Mediterranean today and who are at the bottom of the sea. And it is a shame upon our time that we let this catastrophe happen. I don't know how that should be forgiven.
In most ways, my grandmother lived an ordinary life. She had three kids, divorced once, married twice. She was a custodian, then a nurse, then a teacher. When her kids graduated high school, she rented out their rooms for extra income. She swam in any water she could, no matter how cold. And she ate fire. She'd do this magic trick where she'd take a match or a birthday candle, light it, and then stick the flame in her mouth to put it out. As a grandmother, she let all us grandchildren make her these disgusting concoctions that she would promise to drink. Turkey fat, milk, hot sauce, orange juice, juice of herring. We'd pour it all in. Then we'd run over to her, drop a little garnish on top, and in front of all our parents, present her with our cocktail. She'd take the glass and chug it, the whole thing, then hand it back. Anything to make us laugh. Her face looked like mine, but older. In 2010, she died, in her bed, at home, surrounded by her family. It felt like a normal life, a good life. But there was something different about her. In the back of her head, she knew that she shouldn't be here.
All right, so I just want to remind our listeners that January 27th is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And currently there's an exhibit at the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg on the rescue of the Danish Jews. And of course, there's an exhibit of your work, Rachel, from We Share the Same Sky. And I encourage everybody to go and visit the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Pete and check out those exhibits. Rachel, before we end, I want to ask, what are you working on now? Give us your new project, give us your website, and tell us how people can find more information about your project. Very quickly, please.
Sure. Yep. You can just Google We Share the Same Sky, and you'll find the book, the educational materials, the podcast, the exhibition information. And then my other podcast is called Along the Seam, and I'm into season two now, and that is a series of conversations with individuals about inherited memory.
Well, that's terrific, and I thank you for being with us today. My guest, Rachel Cerati, talking to us about her project, We Share the Same Sky, about her grandmother's history as a refugee, memory, and I encourage you to listen to that podcast on your own. I want to thank my WMNF volunteers, Jessica Green, my sound operator, Barbara Fling, who answers our phones, and ask you to remember to tune in next week to hear from our Democratic House leader, Fentress Driscoll. Next up is Duncan Strauss with Talking Animals. We are WMNF Tampa, and we are out today.